Hello, welcome to the Stock Out. Happy Monday. I'm Mike Baumdistel, joined by Grace Sharkey. And Grace, just what we needed, another retail subscription service.
I told myself this isn't happening. And we'll get into this a little bit too. I think it's interesting seeing other ways that you can get the subscription in a way, right? Where we'll talk about Shipt a little bit too and some alternatives. But yeah, here we go. Another service, another subscription that people need to, we'll probably sign up for free, I assume, at some point and forget it's there to the next time it fills them.
Okay, so we're going to break down Target Circle 360 in a minute here, which should not be confused with J.B. Hunt 360 or Xbox 360. Prep Regents seem to love that number. They need to use some other numbers other than 360. But before we do that, I want to make sure everyone knows how to sign up for the Stockout newsletter. You can do that at www.freightwaves.com/the-stockout. I'll send out a newsletter every Thursday or Friday. There's also a link in the newsletters for a discount code to the FreightWaves Conference in Atlanta, June 4th and 5th. Hope to see some stockouters there. And with that, we'll get into it. So if you haven't seen the news, Target launches a subscription service. This is kind of the basics here. It's called Target Circle 360, $49 a year introductory price. That's going to increase to $99 in May. I guess if you have the card that gives you a little bit of a discount, 5% discount, it's going to stay evergreen at $49. It stays at $49, which is nice. And this service signs up, gives you free same-day service on orders over $35 and free two-day service. And I guess there's a narrower group of workers who collect the same-day orders. So people dedicated, I guess, there's maybe that means it goes even faster. People dedicated to Target Circle 360, and they can personalize shopping, access the Shipt Marketplace, which offers same-day delivery on retailers beyond Target. Okay, so those are kind of the basics. It does not include any video streaming service, if people care about the streaming services. And so it's kind of an offshoot of program that, you know, they already had kind of the one that there wasn't a subscription for. And so, so from your perspective, I mean, how does this fit into the marketplace of all the other subscription services?
I mean, to be honest with you, it doesn't seem comparable right now, at least on the surface. I don't know if we're going to learn more about it, but you're right. You add I think it's Paramount Plus, right, that Walmart offers. I mean, that's a good almost $10 subscription alone by itself, right? So that's some extra value that you add to the Walmart one. I don't believe that Target's even like third-party seller marketplace is that extraordinary as well. And I'm also interested in like, you know, you get Amazon Prime, say with Walmart Plus, right? Like how much of their stock and inventory is going to fall underneath this plus or this 360 category, right? Like oftentimes you'll, depending on the seller, you might not actually be able to get the two-day shipping or some of those promotions. So I'm also interested in that because I just don't know if 100% their warehousing structure, their inventory structure could meet that as it has. The other issue I have with it is, and something you put in the notes, I'm happy you did, was Shipt is already existing for Target buyers as well. And for the amount that you pay for Shipt, which is pretty close, at least to the yearly account or yearly subscription, I think of that $99, you can also go to grocery stores and Best Buy and a number of other companies as well. So I don't know what the benefits are of like a red card holder. I would assume maybe those would help stack onto this, but at the same time, I don't think that it's anything too crazy besides like a 5% discount for what you're doing as well. Regardless of, the name also is strange to me because they do have a rewards program or more of like a coupon program called Target Circle. So this you could still be a Target Circle user and not have to pay this fee. And it seems like experience at least the coupon side of it, which sounds like is going to get much better as well over this next year. So I will say that did seem strange to me that this is more of a defensive move, if anything. It's seeing what Walmart is doing, seeing what Amazon is doing to some type of offering that's putting some type of offering on the table to at least attract customers. Because yes, there are positives to these subscription models. I mean, you see a huge amount of loyalty come back from it as well. So I'm not surprised by that. I think I was looking up some of the some studies on this in particular, and it's a company called Hewitt did a survey, and I mean, it's over 70% of loyalty comes from this for a long period of time. But the big part of this is what they're looking for, and customers in these programs are looking for tailored recommendations, right? So to learn more about the consumer, which hopefully this would help with, and they could start doing that. Early access to sales, which you saw Walmart Plus, right? It was huge on this for the Christmas shopping season. So we'll see maybe if that comes around during more of the holiday shopping season. And then also access to new products, which they haven't qualified if that or spoken if that's going to be something that's involved with this, but it just doesn't seem very competitive to compare to those in the space. Maybe if you're just like an anti-Walmart type of person and you've always been about Target, this is going to be perfect for you, I assume. But I think if someone are asking me, how can I get better deals from Target specifically, I mean, I would probably point them to Shipt, where you get the option to choose so many other stores. And it's the exact same amount of groceries, I think $35, that's exactly what Shipt is. So maybe, I mean, in a way, if maybe because it's owned by Target or Kroger, they're nervous about this Albertson deal, and this is like their defensive move against it, and maybe stepping out of the Shipt offering, but seems not as competitive as you would expect it to be.
Yeah, I would say that it did seem like a defensive move. I mean, it seems like Target was potentially worried about people who are traditional Target shoppers defecting to Walmart because of the Walmart Plus offering. That yeah. Walmart Plus offering actually seems pretty compelling. I think it gives you a lot of the advantages that an Amazon subscription offers, considering that Walmart's building out their marketplace, and also a lot of the advantages that Costco order offers because it has that, you know, discounts on gasoline and, you know, good prices mm-hmm. and things. So it seems like, well, if this is a program for people that are already in the Target ecosystem, I don't know that they're going to convert a lot of people who are not existing Target shoppers to shop at Target for this, but maybe to not go and use Walmart. I agree with you. I mean, a lot of the people that at least I know that use Target, it's kind of because they hate Walmart. Walmart's kind of a dump. It's hard to find things. Now, Walmart's remodeling a lot of those stores. And really, it's not as bad as you think it is if you haven't been to a Walmart in 10 years or something. But it seems like maybe the mistake Target has made historically is it's just they haven't built out the grocery offering to the same extent. So yeah, if you're someone who cares about delivery of the groceries, and Walmart, you know, Plus seems more compelling. And the other thing that strikes me is that I think virtually everyone who shops at Target already has an Amazon Prime subscription, just based on sheer numbers. Like we've talked about that in the past, there's something like 179 million accounts in the United States, something like 200 million overall have Amazon Prime. So that's pretty much everyone that's in that demographic that Target is addressing. That's just maybe a little bit higher than, you know, maybe upper middle class, if you want to call it that. I think a little bit a higher demographic than a Walmart. So they compete sort of directly with them. And I don't think people want to have four or five retail subscriptions. I think a lot of people have Amazon, and then they also have Costco, because there's such polar opposites of what you would use them for and what they're good at. And Walmart sort of, you could conceivably replace Amazon and Costco with just Walmart. But I don't think Target really, you know, fits a need that some of these others don't have. But I think they kind of have to have it just to, you know, just to sort of to not lose customers to other services. So I think that was all this is interesting. Some of the other things that are happening at Walmart that we can go over, you know, quickly is, you know, stock actually performed well on Tuesday. It was the best performing stock in the S&P 500. I didn't think their same store sales were all that impressive. They say for 2024, flat to up 2%. They said, so the comparable sales in the quarter fell 4.4%. Number of visitors to store retailers fell 1.7%. So that's not as good as what some of the other retailers are experiencing. If you look at Walmart and Costco, I mean, their same store sales have been better. Their traffic has been better. They did mention some things about logistics. They said Target's slowing the number of large warehouse investments because of the demand they're seeing for home delivery is cooling since the pandemic. They did say they had lower freight, supply chain, and fulfillment costs. So I think that certainly makes sense on the freight side. But it's interesting that maybe they're starting to get some economies of scale there on supply chain and fulfillment as well. And then they're also increasing the number of sortation centers, which they now have 10 of them. And those are related to, you know, some of the omni-channel and those things. And in terms of share of e-commerce, Target's at 1.8% of e-commerce versus Walmart's in that quarter, that 6-7% range. Then Amazon has 38%. So it sounds like you don't think Target's going to be a e-commerce giant anytime soon.
Yeah, not anytime soon. I mean, even it's just I've shopped online for Target numerous times too. And like, if I want to pick up in 2 hours, like, usually that's available already for it. So it's like, for me, what am I, if I'm paying more for just to have someone deliver, which again, mm-hmm. I can go to Shipt, I can go to, I mean, I think DoorDash too, and a number of other Instacart, right? And get those things to me if I need something that fast. I just don't know if that convenience is as wanted from the Target audience as others that we see out there too. So yeah, well, we'll see how it grows. I'm hoping that they expand on it, and I am excited to like kind of go back and look at this during the holiday season and see if we do see more of that kind of like early offerings on certain promotions, or like Walmart, I think had, right, they opened up their like Black Friday shopping 2 weeks early for Walmart Plus users or something along those lines. So if we see some like that come out, it might be a little bit more of an attractive offering. But right now, it just seems almost like rushed in a way, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it does seem. It just seems like people who, it is for people who are already in the Target ecosystem. I mean, Target seems to be addressing the market of, you know, it's kind of the busy parent who has the kid sleeping in the back seat. They can pull up, get the stuff delivered to their trunk. They can also return from the curbside, get their Starbucks delivered, which they need that caffeine for their lifestyle and all that without getting out of their car. That's sort of their market. And maybe that's a Target 360, you know, customer. want to move on to sort of the freight market. And this is something I wanted to ask you, because when I was reading through the material we have on the freight rates writes up, when my colleagues wrote up the tender rejection rates. And what's interesting is those that have been falling pretty significantly. Now, what everyone's been saying the last few weeks is, okay, everyone knows February is weak, and February was weak. February is always weak. We're now 11 days into March, and those new tender rejection rates falling, we're at 3.44%. Now, you do see the tender rejection rates in the white line there, if you can see the screen. The red line is the volume. So you did see a volume pickup right at the end of February. Doesn't seem to have moved the needle on rejections. We're looking at just van here, both on the volume side and the tender rejection rate. So, you know, I wanted to ask you, from your experience in the brokerage world, you know, March usually is kind of the make or break month for the first quarter, right? So when does it usually pick up? And is it usually kind of early month, early in the March, middle of March? When do you usually see it?
I mean, honestly, I would probably say I'm surprised to not see it already. And I think even in some of our forecasting models, right, from looking at year over year from the past, we expected to see it a little bit sooner as well, and then kind of fall off a little bit near the end of the month. And that's not happening at all. Now, on a positive note, I mean, over the weekend, we saw some movement in the NTI, just like a couple of pennies, but not this. We've been just stagnant at like $2.21, I think, over the past like week or so. And so it's good to see that starting to move up. I am surprised to not see it bouncing back already. I will say, I mean, this is a perfect example. We brought this up, I think, in the Daily Watch for those who get that this past week. This is the time of the year, though, for flatbed to start to take off. And we started to see those rejection rates rise pretty high to, I think, like 19% or something along those lines. And likely to see spot rates follow with that, too. So, I mean, this is construction season starting. As soon as, you know, the snow starts to go away in some of these states up here That's when a lot of those construction vehicles, and of course, so those have to be delivered somehow, and that flatbed market starts to take off. So this is kind of showcases to you the importance of keeping that book diversified during this time of the year, so that you can kind of maybe hedge a little bit of what you've lost in van with a little bit of this uptick in flatbed. But I think in the van side of things, we're still seeing this struggle to see capacity leave faster than or quicker than we or we hope that it would go quicker than it has. But I will say there was an interesting truck stops survey that I got last week, too, from our good friends over there at truckstop.com, that carriers are expecting to see aren't feeling as happy about the market. 12% think that this will be the last quarter that they're into it. So if we start to see, I think, some of that capacity continue to fall off, we see Clarissa Hawes covering a lot of that right now, too. Hopefully we can see that flip. But yeah, I'm surprised to not have seen it already this month. That's what, before this episode, I'm like, we're pretty much halfway through it, if not a couple of days off. So I don't think this is going to be as wonderful of a March that especially brokers have hoped to see. But those who have diversified their portfolio might be able to catch up a little bit and come out of the Q1 a little bit better than they had hopefully hoped.
Yeah. So if you're an investment fund, you might want to be positioned defensively going into the first quarter earnings reports. And good point about the flatbed. I mean, that's been a different story. I mean, I would think the flatbed would be strong really for the foreseeable future, just because the biggest issue right now is the housing crunch. There's not enough single family houses. As long as I guess the governments get out of the way and allow homes to be built, then the market would correct for that imbalance. But default zoning laws and town hall meetings don't allow that, then I guess we'll be stuck with high home prices forever, potentially. Want to move on to the next topic. This was an article that John Kingston wrote up over the weekend, or maybe not over the weekend, on March 7th, but it was really, I think, helpful for this audience. So this is the audience that is primarily focused on sitting with retailers and CPGs. This is a big deal for CPGs in particular. The SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, is backing off requirements to report Scope 3 emissions. So the SEC, the government organization that requires the publicly traded companies to disclose, certain things in their filings every quarter and every year. And if anything is material and non-public, that needs to be disclosed too. And backed off at least the requirements for Scope 3. They are going to require Scope 1 and 2. Now, if you're not familiar with these, Scope 1 is companies' own plant and fleet. It's your manufacturing, let's say you're manufacturing a CPG item, it's your own facilities, that would be Scope 1. Scope 2 would be the impact of suppliers' raw materials. So you're making Oreos and you're sourcing palm oil. It's the impact of that palm oil, the raw material. Scope 3 would be something like the electricity that a supplier uses in generating those raw materials or in that processing. And that's harder to, get your arms around, because it requires, relying on accurate reporting from all of the suppliers. And some of the suppliers might be smaller companies. And the point was well made that if those suppliers are not publicly traded companies, it really falls out of the SEC's jurisdiction. I mean, they're really only pertain to securities that can be publicly traded, and privately held companies aren't to disclose much of anything, really, at least not publicly. So they're not going to do Scope 3. I guess there were some good quotes in there from the Gartner group that John Kingston, highlighted. They didn't think it was a surprise that they wouldn't require the Scope 3 emissions. I mean, this was something that was proposed in 2022. And Gartner also said that, even though they're not going to require the Scope 3, it's really the Scope 3 that drives most of the climate risk and emissions. They peg that at 90% of the climate risk is in the value chain. So, I think that makes a lot of sense. Is there's just so many suppliers and points and transportation, components. So just sort of think of just the morning coffee you're drinking. Just, it's not the Smucker company that's producing most of those emissions. It's really, further in the value chain. So I thought that was interesting. I wanted to ask you, I mean, did you track any of those things when you were in brokerage, or is it something that you didn't do that?
No, not at all. And I think, you know, there's some level that you'd kind of track just internally for the, I think, especially like the recycling side and things of that nature. But one, even like requiring that from, imagine like trying to get all of the carriers that you work with to follow along with this or report this to you as well. That would be next to impossible, especially, I mean, there's a large portion of brokers out there that work like heavily off the spot market. So they're, you know, working with carriers every once in a while. So you're not building this huge, big relationship with some of those carriers that you could maybe leverage to get this information on top of like even just our own as a brokerage, like, I mean, down to what your own carbon footprint is inside your building, how you're, you know, disposing and recycling of paper and even down to employee travel, right? It gets like very, very condensed with the amount of data and information that you're looking for people to hand over. And I just think, I mean, we already see a lack of technology, basic technology updates within a lot of our industry as well, especially the farther you go down that supply chain, right? Deeper, especially into a lot of these carriers who maybe have one or two trucks and are barely keeping up with, you know, just keeping their own operations afloat, let alone finding the time and expertise to report any of this back to you, I think takes a lot. And then on top of it, kind of the argument that they're saying, I mean, kind of reminds me of like the regulation that the federal government was asking for freight forwarders when it comes to helping with fentanyl and illegal drugs. Like, what's the incentive for me to take that extra step? If I'm a privately held company, you're not going to kick me off of the stock market or anything like that because I didn't report this back to you. So now you might lose out on working with some of these large CPG companies. And that's a pretty big incentive, right? To lose out of that business. But at the same time, again, it's I think the jurisdiction aspect, right, of like we're private for a reason. We shouldn't have to report this or take these extra steps is big. And I think, again, we're just so far behind in a lot of these spaces of or maybe chains of the supply chain that I don't think it'd be as easy as one would think even trying to get the exact number on those scope threes.
Yeah, it's a big deal potentially in the investment community too, because I mean, one thing I noticed as a stock analyst is the clients in Europe much more focused on having ESG funds and funds that were good for the environment, you know, funds consisting of companies that were good for the environment, that had low carbon footprints, and just having numbers that are audited there. I think it makes a big difference for what can be included in a certain portfolio. I mean, every company claims to be the greenest company out there, but you know, not everyone is. So I think it's a big deal for, you know, in investing, you know, particularly in some of these European funds. You know, I want to move on to the next story. Just wanted to highlight this one quickly. I only have a couple minutes here. So this was written up by Tony Mulvey. He's taken over some of the coverage of the ocean market. This one was helpful. Mm-hmm. Carriers pricing power slipping amid continued Red Sea conflict. And, you know, I have a sonar chart to that effect where, you know, I think it's encouraging that, you know, look at the Freightos Baltic Daily Index, that those numbers are off of their highs. And so that was kind of one of the points I was making. I was at a retail conference the other week, and, you know, the topic was disruptions potentially from, you know, some of these geopolitical events. And I sort of said, well, you know, this is kind of what the market's telling us as far as disruption. You know, what is the market telling us in terms of spot rates? And you're like, well, you know, just sort of take this back to 2019 and say, look at what we went through in 2021 and 2022. And this doesn't seem like that big of a deal. And now it really seems like, you know, less of a deal because those have peaked and have come down. And so it's a type of thing with the Red Sea. I mean, you know, feel bad for some of the people involved in those in those events, but you know, it's something that supply chains can adjust to, and would encourage people to go check out that article. It's another good one up on the site that I think puts a lot of this in good context.
Yeah, especially I had the conversation about that this weekend as well. Like, I think this is something as we are all mindful of it as it first started, but it's interesting to see how our supply chains bend to them and find different ways and dealing with the extra routing around Africa as well. Unfortunate, right? I think a lot more for the European supply chains in particular, but it seems like we've been able to get out of this. Definitely not as bad as we saw, right? Like you said, in 21, for sure.
Well, great. So check out those articles and sign up for the newsletter and sign up for your tickets for Atlanta. And that's about all the time we have. Hope everyone has a good start to the week.